This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. The new movies this week are Kung Fu Panda 3, The Finest Hours, 50 Shades of Black, Laser Team, and one of my favorites every year, the Oscar-nominated shorts. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Let's jump right into the news with a very sad rest in peace to Abe Vigoda, who was 94 years old. That is extremely old, and it's always sad to see somebody pass, especially a favorite actor. And, you know, Abe Vigoda was never going to be a leading man, but he shows up in a lot of things. I mean, he's in The Godfather. I grew up watching him on Barney Miller as Fish. And this is in the 80s, was probably when I was watching this stuff on reruns. I mean, the guy was in his 50s when he shot those episodes, and I was watching, and he was in his 60s at that point by the time I was watching him. He was old then, but he lasted until 94. That is impressive. And I even remember back in the 90s and into the 2000s when I'd watch Conan O'Brien. He'd show up on Conan O'Brien in just bit parts. But, I mean, here was a guy who had such a huge career as a supporting or character actor. And I've known actors my whole life, and a lot of them always, they want to be the big star. And there's a lot of them that you just don't have it. You have that it factor where you could become the leading man. Somebody like Tom Cruise or Will Smith, they can carry a movie, but there's not everybody can do that. Not everybody has that. That's intangible, and it's not something you can create. You have it or you don't. And Abe Vigoda made one heck of a career for himself without that, but he was very recognizable and very good. So it's sad to see him go, even at age 94, and that's impressive. That's how I want to go out. The next piece of news I want to talk about, this is sort of dovetails into the Oscars so white controversy, because it is like the greatest news story that hit this week that snubs that entire argument. Apparently, Joseph Fiennes will be playing Michael Jackson in a movie that the BBC's doing about this weird little post 9/11 road trip that Michael Jackson, Marlon Brando, and Elizabeth Taylor took. As Stockard Channing's going to play Elizabeth Taylor, that's a relatively normal casting decision. But Joseph Fiennes, as Michael Jackson, of course, that enraged people, because this is all amid the fact that there aren't as many opportunities for African-Americans or black people, because obviously it's a British production. And here's Joseph Fiennes playing Michael Jackson. But it's such a bizarre thing, because Michael Jackson went through so much to make himself not look black, that by the end of his life, and certainly by early 2000s, Michael Jackson didn't look African-American at all. In fact, in the art I saw accompanying the story, it had a picture of the two of them, you know, a stock picture of Michael Jackson, a stock picture of Joseph Fiennes. And Joseph Fiennes is considerably darker than he is in the picture. If there's ever a point where you want to cast a white guy as a black guy, it's somebody playing Michael Jackson. Another piece of news is Doctor Who apparently is, first of all, it's leaving Netflix, which might be a negotiation. They do this anytime the BBC contract's up, and it's just Doctor Who that's on the chopping block. The new episodes, a reboot, and the old series. And supposedly it's all ending on February 1st. We'll see if they come up with it. The last time this happened, they came at 11th hour to keep it, but they dumped other British shows like Snuffbox or a favorite of some people being Red Dwarf. And I love Red Dwarf, so it was sad to see that one go. But in even deeper matters, apparently they're not going to have any new Doctor Who episodes in 2016 except for a Christmas special. And then Stephen Moffat is leaving as showrunner. Which I think's okay, because Stephen Moffat does some really great stuff, but he gets very depressing and a defeatist in his writing, and everything crumbles in on itself. And I think they want a fresh start. new showrunner. And in the process, Peter Capaldi is probably going to step down as a doctor. Now, I predicted that Peter Capaldi was going to stick around forever, but I don't think he's clicking with the fans the way Matt Smith and David Tennant did. Those are great fan favorites, and they brought in a lot of young people watching, and they expanded the viewership. And I don't know if you've got that expanded viewership, especially in America, with Peter Capaldi. So I think they're going to sort of give the reboot a reboot and get a brand new doctor. Personally, I'd love to see Richard Iotti do it, and he's probably not even in the running, but I'd love to see him as it. We might get a female Doctor Who. Who knows? They've already set the stage for that with the Master turning into Missy. So get ready for that to happen. Another piece of news is Star Wars Episode 8 has moved from the summer of 2017 into the December 15th, 2017 slot. Couple things that you can take away from this. This happened a week or two ago. Disney was extremely happy with how Star Wars The Force Awakens played by releasing right before Christmas. Every other Star Wars movie that was ever made in terms of the six released in the summer. It was like a Memorial Day weekend push. This is the first one that was released in December, and that helped it get some huge legs. It didn't just have that opening weekend, but it had multiple weekends following it, which a lot of times in the summer, you get the big one or two weekends, but within a 3 weeks or so, it's burned out because there's other stuff coming out. When you release it right before Christmas, all you have to deal with are the Christmas releases and then nothing for a couple weeks into January. So I think they want to repeat that. I don't think they're going to repeat the numbers. They won't get the anticipated box office. But what that also says is that says Avatar 2, which has never had that date locked in. But Fox was always sort of saying it was going to be then. And Cameron was. Well, apparently Avatar 2 has been postponed indefinitely again. I mean, it's taking so long. We're going to have the 10-year reunion of Avatar in theaters. A lot of this is because Cameron's a perfectionist. And he's probably developing new technology. And also Cameron will usually wait 10 or 12 years between movies. So we'll see how well this Avatar 2, I think Avatar 2 might have a softer play in America, unless it's really pioneering something. And who knows? I mean, maybe Cameron's got something up his sleeve. But bottom line is for right now, Star Wars is now going to be an annual Christmas time release because we got Rogue One in 2016 and Episode 8 in 2017. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is one that actually caught a lot of eyes when it dropped, and that is Keanu, which no, it has nothing to do with Keanu Reeves. It is the first feature film from Key and Peele, who are the comedians. They had a TV show on Comedy Central, and you see them showing up everywhere. They're very, very funny, and they're irreverent, and they do great sketch comedy. And this is their first feature film in which one of their new cats gets stolen.
I want you to meet Keanu. Till the end
of time. No. Oh my God, that's the cutest cat I've ever seen in my life.
Why is your door open?
Keanu.
Keanu!
I'm sorry.
Oh! I am not breaking the law.
We just feed him some bullet about New Jack City, and we get Keanu.
Keanu needs you. I need you.
This is in some ways very lowbrow, it looks like, but it's also very highbrow because there's references to all these Keanu Reeves movies, but they don't hit you over the head with it. I mean, you got references to The Matrix, John Wick. It seems that the two of them went and saw John Wick and then wrote this movie. So it looks like it's going to be funny. I'm looking forward to it. It opens on April 29th. The next one I want to highlight is Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, and that opens on May 20th.
In the United States, sororities are not allowed to throw parties in their own houses. Only frats can.
This is a sexist, restrictive system.
Workers are a sorority. They can party the way that we want to.
We're never going to sell our house with a sorority living next door. What are we going to do?
We need somebody who can relate to stupid young people.
Hey, neighbors. Let's shut down.
Those girls are out of control.
Get away from me!
They're using their sexuality as a weapon.
I liked Neighbors. I thought Neighbors was funny. The problem is when you have an unplanned comedy sequel, sometimes it doesn't go so well. Part of what made Neighbors work was a certain grounding that Seth Rogen and Rose Byrne gave to the movie. If you don't have that in this movie, it loses the oomph. Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, looks like it could be funny, but you know, who knows? Everything good could be in the trailers. That's it for the Trailer Park. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 50 Shades of Black and Laser Team. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's roll into the movie reviews. Let's kick things off with 50 Shades of Black. The horny housewife fanfiction phenom gets a raunchy send-up by Marlon Wayans in the tradition of a haunted house.
I'm just the dominant.
Show me the worst.
Service!
Did you break my stool?
No.
We have to talk.
You mean like white people?
What's wrong with that?
When they start throwing around all these big SAT words, I like it the black way.
What you not gonna do?
Oh, no, what you not gonna do? You are not about to... Oh, don't let me get to clapping, boo.
See? That's communication.
Big surprise. This was not screened for critics. This is a case where it not being screened for critics means exactly what you think it means by it not being screened for critics. This movie is awful. This movie stinks so bad, it's almost incomprehensible. And it's not even found footage. Marlon Wayans had done the Haunted House movies. Both of those were send-ups of found footage films. Not this one. This one is a regular shot movie. It is honestly trying to be a spoof of 50 Shades of Grey. But of course, when I saw this coming out, I thought to myself, is there really enough material in 50 Shades of Grey, the movie, to spoof for an entire feature film? I mean, I get that there's an entire movie there, but once you get past sort of the taboo and the character's introduction to this sort of fake BDSM life that E.L. James sets up in 50 Shades of Grey, there's not much there. And even what is spoofable in this movie, they don't take advantage of it. I don't know. I can't imagine what the process was in writing this movie. What's amazing about this film is I literally only laughed once. That is a feat. Even the worst comedy, even like the Meet the Spartans Love Guru level of worst comedy, I will find myself saying, okay, that's a funny joke. Okay, that was a good delivery. Every now and then you at least swerve into something decent. This movie has none of it. So many jokes fall flat. So many jokes are either telegraphed from the beginning or just not delivered very well. And it doesn't even make sense within the setup of a spoof. I don't even think that they did the spoof right, because it's not even like spoofing 50 Shades of Grey as much as it is just telling a really stupid comedy that's not very funny with the essentially same characters of 50 Shades of Grey, shot essentially looking the same way in that very pallid, humdrum, not terribly dynamic or exciting world. I mean, no wonder Marlon Wayans' own family won't work with him anymore. I mean, there was a time when his brother Keenan Ivory Wayans was directing his stuff, like The Terrible Little Man and the Terrible White Chicks. He did both of those with his brother Sean. But once he started doing Haunted House, it's almost like he came to his brothers and said, I got this idea for a movie. And they're like, yeah, this kind of needs work. Do you want to workshop it with the rest of the family? We can bring in all, you know, all of our siblings and we can all work on your script. Nope, this is mine. I don't want to have anything to do with you. And then he started making these movies by himself. And as bad as White Chicks and Little Man were with the other Wayan brothers involved, this one's even worse. It is so bad that there was a group that came into the theater, a good 10, 15 minutes in. I was assuming that they didn't buy tickets because the theater I went to go see this, it has 20 minutes of trailers. So they were arriving more than a half hour late for the movie. I'm assuming they didn't pay. I'm assuming they came out of another movie and decided to come in here and see what it was like. And they sat down. They didn't even sit through the whole movie. These people snuck into the movie, watched about half of it, and were like, that's enough for me, and left. And this was the target market. These are like teenagers and, you know, early 20s. People who are just the kind of people that would sneak into a movie as a group. And it's so funny. It's a kind of amazing that it comes out right at the time where the Oscar So White controversy is happening. Because if anything, this movie can certainly be used as an example of Hollywood not giving African Americans very good roles or many good roles. This movie is about as funny as a used colostomy bag. No, scratch that. A colostomy bag is way funnier than this movie. I'm insulting the colostomy bag by comparing it to 50 Shades of Black. 50 Shades of Black is intensely terrible and awful. I mean, impressively awful. It absolutely, totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. What's nice about reviewing something like 50 Shades of Black and kicking off the reviews on the week with that, you can only go up. Even a bad movie from this point on is going to be great compared to 50 Shades of Black. But let's talk about another one that might even be better than that, and that is Laser Team. A group of idiots stumble upon an alien spacesuit with superpowers intended for a highly trained soldier to use to defend Earth from an alien threat.
After multiple reports of a UFO sighting in Milford, Texas, a Twitter post showing several men at what appears to be the crash site has gone viral.
In less than 5 days, an alien warrior will arrive to do battle with whoever is wearing this suit to the death.
How do we get these things off?
You'll now begin your formal training to utilize your gifts.
Pardon me, old chap. I have a question.
What? Does he sound British now?
That's what stupid people think smart people sound like.
This is kind of a smaller movie, and it's available online, but it's also getting a theatrical rollout. It's notable because it had its money raised through Indiegogo, which I believe it raised more than $1 million from sort of a crowdfunding campaign, and got a distribution deal partly with YouTube Red. We've had these before. You know, you had the Veronica Mars movie that got crowdfunded, and you had a Zach Braff movie, but this one is still on the fringe. This one feels like a bunch of YouTubers got together and made a pretty good movie. It's a send-up of 80s sci-fi action movies. And it's sort of like you can imagine the characters in this. It's not that they were the Goonies or the Explorers, but that they pretended they were when they were preteens and then grew up to live miserable lives. And they come together and they kind of put this hodgepodge spacesuit together. And they have to be the ones to defend Earth. And so it's a pretty simple premise, but it's fun. And it feels like one of those old alien invasion kind of stuff, like Critters or Night of the Creeps. These kind of films that were really hot in the mid to late 80s. And it totally nails that tone. It's a very funny movie. It has some very funny moments. It's only PG-13. And that's actually kind of good. I know a lot of people rail on PG-13. But the reason the PG-13 rating works in this is because it's not trying to be crazy or offensive or over the top. It still has its edge because it gets PG-13 humor. And it has some jokes that are off color or whatever. But it's not trying to break any boundaries. It's just trying to be a fun space adventure. And the effects look great. For a $1 million crowdfunded movie, the effects look fantastic. They hold up partly because they don't overdo the effects. They use the effects that they need, and then they don't try and make it bigger. And you see that a lot with big movies that get a significant budget behind it, because they have the money, might as well do more digital effects. They don't here. They use them as they need with practical effects. It's a fun movie. Check out Laser Team. You can get it on demand. It's also locally in theaters around the country. So check it out. It's totally worth seeing, especially if you're a child of the 80s like myself. It rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for those reviews. I need to go to a break. When I come back, let's talk about two new movies, Kung Fu Panda 3 and The Finest Hours. Take a seat. seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, rolling through the movie reviews. Let's dial back a little bit from the more grown-up humor and talk about the kids' movies for the weekend, and that is Kung Fu Panda 3. Po the Panda finds his father and reconnects with his panda family while trying to defeat the ultimate warrior returned from the underworld.
Come home with me. You must rediscover what it is to be a panda.
Yeah! I have returned!
Who?
The Master of Pain, Beast of Vengeance, Maker of Widows. Mm-hmm. Okay, I used to work with Oogway.
Oh, Master Oogway!
Silence!
You must save the world.
There's no way I can stop him.
Unless you had an army of your own.
You don't even know Kung Fu.
Then you will teach us.
Both part one and part two, I thought were going to suck. I really was dreading. In fact, I wrote an article back in 2008 that named Kung Fu Panda as one of the movies in the summer that's sure going to suck. Now, other movies on that list were stuff like Meet Dave with Eddie Murphy and You Don't Mess with the Zohan with Adam Sandler. I was totally right with those. But Kung Fu Panda ended up being one of my favorite movies of 2008. I loved that movie. And I thought that it just did exactly what it needed to do, but it was coming off of movies like Shark Tale, which also had Jack Black in it. And that was a terrible disaster of a movie. And the second one I had reservations about as well, because I was like, oh no, is this just going to be derivative? Are they going to do something different? And they did. They did some fantastic stuff. Both films look gorgeous. They were both summer releases, though. Now, what's funny is Kung Fu Panda 3, I remember hearing about it, but then it just has such an odd release schedule. I mean, I know they bumped it. They were going to have it in the Christmas time frame, and then they're going to do it in the summer. And they decided to get out of everybody's way and drop it in January. Now, in 2016, it seems the studios are really starting to play with release dates. I mean, biggest example is Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice. That's a summer movie. It's coming out in spring break. So I think they're starting to expand their release schedules, and I think this might be part of the experiment. Can we get a big summer movie to release in January? Now, keeping in mind that the first two movies were not juggernauts. They did well, but they weren't great. In terms of box office, they were hits. But they opened with like 40-some million, 6 to 60 million, which isn't that $100 million opening that stuff like the Toy Story and Pixar movies tend to do. This one, I was a little bit nervous of because of the release date, and they had started a TV show called Kung Fu Panda Legends of Awesomeness a couple years ago, which I saw a couple episodes of, and it was cute, but not great. And it's almost 5 years since the last movie. But I will say, this one definitely works. I brought my kids, they enjoyed it, and it has some gorgeous animation. Now, it's weird because the animation isn't jaw-dropping anymore, but I think that's just because CGI animation has gotten so sophisticated, we're used to it now. It's no longer impressive. Sort of like if you watch Jurassic Park. Remember how wowed you were at the first Jurassic Park? And then compare it to how maybe not wowed you were with Jurassic World. As fun as that movie was, it wasn't jaw-dropping because we'd seen dinosaurs before. Whereas when you first saw them in 1993 with Jurassic Park, it was mind-blowing. And that's sort of the way that Kung Fu Panda is. Kung Fu Panda 3 looks beautiful and probably actually looks better than the other movies, but it's just less impressive because everybody has those tools and technology. Now, with that said, the story works. It forces it a little bit, but you see him with his family, and you got like Kate Hudson in this weird, extremely minor role, but she's really pumped up in the advertising and marketing. I think that her role was probably bigger, and either she didn't work in the role, either the role didn't work, or it just was extraneous stuff that they needed to cut out for time. It wasn't as good as the first two. And they're talking about wanting to do six of these. So they have three more in the works. We'll see how well this one does. Like I said, it was a gamble to move it into a January window. So this might kill the franchise. But then again, it's coming out in kind of a vacuum right now. There really hasn't been a huge kids movie. And stuff like Norm of the North never really took off. So maybe this will be a good shot. But ultimately, I thought Kung Fu Panda 3 kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the finest hours. In 1952, a Coast Guard rescue team braves dangerous seas to save a group of sailors stranded on a boat that has split in half.
We got maybe 3 hours, and then we sink.
Mayday, mayday, do you copy?
Pick yourself a crew, and you assist that ship.
It's your job to go out, right?
Coast Guard, they say you gotta go out. They don't say you gotta come back in.
I'm not giving up on them.
We all live, or we all die.
What's interesting about Disney as a company is they're known for animated films, and they're known for now the big blockbusters because they bought Marvel and Lucasfilm. And those are what people are have their eyes on Disney for. But Disney still has a little niche audience that they do like inspirational sports movies. You see those periodically. I think Million Dollar Arm was the last one they did. And you also have true life inspirational stories. And they've been doing these movies for decades. And it stars Chris Pine as this Coast Guardsman who takes a group out during like the worst storm imaginable. I mean, so bad they can't even get over the bar to get to the open sea. And that's part of the danger. And I remember back in December when In the Heart of the Sea came out, which is a very different movie. You know, it's a high adventure on the sea, but I mean, it takes place in the 1820s and it's about whaling and it's in the tropics, but we don't get very many of these seafaring movies. And now we're getting two in like 6 or 8 weeks time of each other. This one works better. Part of it is the effects. Now, when it comes to the raging sea and the exteriors, that's all CGI and that's all digital. And you know that now. But the difference between what they did in The Heart of the Sea and what they've done in this is they don't overdo it for backgrounds. I mean, in The Heart of the Sea, it looked like it was shot against a blue screen. And I'm sure there's a lot of blue screen work in this movie, but they tend to hide it better. And there's a lot of these practical effects when they're on the boat, and the boat like literally is cracking in two. They've welded part of it and it cracked and it is taking in water. So they have this engine room and it's a big set and it's pretty impressive. Now, when they're on the sea and they're fighting against the ocean and it's man against nature, that's exciting. And they manage to keep that up as opposed to The Heart of the Sea, which hits a real doldrums at one point when they just get lost at sea. This one is kind of adventure from beginning to end. If there's any real problem with The Finest Hours, it's that they put so much focus on the character Bernie, which is played by Chris Pine. His fiancée is left back on the shore, obviously, because she's not in the Coast Guard. First of all, that's what they're trying to frame the movie around, is this love story, and that's what's keeping him wanting to come home. When really, even if you listen to the dialogue, it's not him trying to get home to his fiancée, it's him for a sense of duty. It's like it's his job to go save people and bring them home. And that's why he's coming home. Not necessarily for the wife or the would-be wife. The movie starts off with them on their first date, and it takes its time to set things up. And I actually kind of respect that. In a movie nowadays, to not just jump in with this big action sequence is pretty daring to do. And they do that. I mean, I don't understand why you need to start with a big action sequence, because people have already bought their tickets and are sitting down. You've got them for 15, 20 minutes before they start walking out of boredom. But the problem is they keep flashing back over to the shore with the woman trying to do it. And you know, here's the thing. It's going to make me sound sexist, and this is not politically correct to say. But in a based on a true story like this in 1952, it was the Coast Guard. It was dudes who were doing this. This is a story about dudes trying to save other dudes. There really aren't any women involved. And because Hollywood is so political, because of that, now they're saying, well, let's make sure we have enough female screen time on here, and it just gets boring. I'm like, who cares? This one, I understand, I get it. She's worried, and you have that. But just as a construct of history, she's not the story. The story is the guys on the boat and the guys in the smaller boat trying to save the guys on the big boat. And that's where it really bogs down. If they would have just edited, like, I'd say 70% of this woman's scene, and she's not bad in it. It's just the character's boring and doesn't really further the plot. So if they would have edited like, you know, half or 70% of her stuff out, it would have been a much better movie and it would have been shorter too. But, you know, politically correct, we can't have a movie with just guys in it now. But that makes the movie suffer a bit. But even with that, I have to say that The Finest Hours kind of rocked.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the full-length feature reviews. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the Oscar-nominated shorts, the box office, and the home cinema roundup. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies for our final run for this week. There's still some great stuff to talk about because one of my favorite things that comes out this time of year are the Oscar-nominated shorts. I love short films. I've always loved short films. If I ever end up at a film festival, and I go to them now and then, I always try and hit the shorts block. And the reason is because especially if it's a film festival where it's something different. Like when I went to Jerusalem in 2014, I made a point to see because I wanted to taste Israeli cinema. And I thought with the shorts program, you can watch a dozen or so short films and really get a taste of the breadth and the depth of the culture and the cinema. So I've always loved short films. And I think that they're an underappreciated genre because people always think in terms of features. But this is where people cut their teeth. And you can tell some really innovative and cool stories in this short time frame, and they can run from just a couple minutes long to about a half hour or so. And one of the greatest things that has come from digital projection in cinemas is it makes these short films available to people. It used to be, it just didn't make sense to strike film prints of a bunch of these films because that's kind of expensive. Well, once they got to digital technology, they could either send you discs or they can send you a hard drive. It's much easier to present this stuff. And ever since about 2008, 2009, they've been presenting these. They've been releasing these in theaters, sometimes major theaters. So you got to check your local listings. And they'll all be available online after the Oscars. But right now is your chance to see them on the big screen in the blocks. Now they have three different blocks because the Oscars nominate five shorts as animated, five shorts as live action, and five shorts as documentary. I did not get a chance to look at the documentary ones, but I will say this with the documentary and the live action, those tend to be very heavy subject matter. You've got stuff like death and war and assault and atrocities and just some pretty heavy duty stuff that comes in those, and they're well done. But they can be a bit punishing at times. I love the animated stuff, though, because you get all types. Sometimes you get very poignant, hard-hitting shorts, but there's always like a whimsical nature to it or a degree of fantasticness that makes the movie pop. Now, in the live-action section, there's one called Ave Maria, which is about a Jewish family that has their car break down on the West Bank. And they're trying to get back to the Jewish sector, and they get to a nunnery, but they can't operate machinery because it's Shabbat and that's forbidden, and it's the nuns trying to help them. So it's an interesting look at, a lot of the Israeli filmmaking is about the Arab Jewish dual state, and that's what this one does, but it's not heavy handed. It's pretty somewhat whimsical, actually. There's also one called Shock, I think, and that's very heavy handed. That takes place during 1998, I think, in Croatia or Kosovo. And of course, you've got the Albanians versus the Serbians, and you've got ethnic cleansing happening. And it's how it affects this one family and these two kids. And it's very hard hitting and uncomfortable to watch at times, but that's very good. There's also one called Stutterer, which is about a guy who is in internet dating. And so he can communicate very, very well through text and through direct messaging, but he can't talk because he stutters and he's crippled by it and he's not getting help for it, which one of the big problems in today's world is people don't seek help for their problems, but it's him trying to find love while he's shackled in a world like this. There's also Day One, which takes place in Afghanistan, about a woman who's a translator who, when they go and they find a bomb maker, his wife goes into labor and she's trying to help deliver the baby because there's sort of taboo. You know, you can't have the male doctor come in because it's shameful and it's a sin, and sort of trying to work around that cultural relativism of being stationed in another country. Now, my favorite is Everything Will Be Okay, which is the story of a German man who is trying to run away with his daughter because he's losing custody. And it's kind of told from the daughter's point of view and how she first thinks it's great and then realizes there's something that might be going wrong. And it's also terrifying to see how this could happen. But it's a very powerful film. It's one of the longer ones, but it's very powerful. Now, in terms of the Oscar-nominated animated shorts, one of the big ones that I think this was one's probably going to win is Sanjay Super Team, which is the short film that was in front of The Good Dinosaur. And it's one of the animators, Sanjay Patel. It's kind of this semi-autobiographical thing about him as a kid watching superheroes. And he's a first generation Indian American and his father's trying to meditate and bring him into there. And it's how the kid merges his faith with his love of superheroes. It's a charming little movie. There's one called Bear Story, which is from Chile, and it's about a bear who makes a clockwork tin diorama that people can pay money, and it sort of tells what might be his story. It's very touching, very poignant, and beautifully animated. There's one called We Can't Live Without Cosmos, which is about two astronauts who are the best of friends and the sacrifices they have to make to become cosmonauts. And then there's one called Prologue, which is beautifully done. And it's about a warrior battle between these warriors. And my biggest problem with this one is it kind of looked like it was a demo reel of what you can do with animation, because it kind of hit all these points. If you've ever watched demo reels of animation, there are certain things that you practice that demonstrate that you can artfully animate certain things. And that seems to be almost like too obvious in this movie. It's an interesting film. It's sketch driven. And then finally, the one I loved, which honestly, Sanjay Super Team was on the top for me. Then there was World of Tomorrow, which is out there. It is a bizarre story about a little girl who receives a call from her future self, who then invites her to come visit her in the future. And it is out there. It has some amazing concepts of both science and philosophy, kind of all mixed together, about self and about identity and about immortality and about love and emotion and our place in the universe. It's an amazing movie. It is quite honestly adorable, terrifying, and impressive all at the same time. So World of Tomorrow, that's my pick for best, but I think Sanjay Super Team is going to win the Oscar.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Now, last week I said Ride Along 2 was going to make $16 million. It didn't. It made about $12.5 million, so it dropped more than I thought it would. And The Revenant made $16 million, and on its heels was Star Wars with $14 million. Now, of course, Star Wars is nipping at $900 million domestic, which is extremely impressive. It's nipping at $2 billion worldwide, which is also impressive. It might overtake Titanic. It's not going to overtake Avatar. Dirty Grandpa, I thought, could do better, but it did. It only did $11 million. And then The Boy was just slightly below that. It was really a horse race between Dirty Grandpa, The Boy, and The Fifth Wave, none of which I thought were ones that they were a huge disappointment, except The Fifth Wave. I think they wanted that to do better because they were hoping for a franchise with that one. Now, this week, Kung Fu Panda is going to win. There's no doubt about that. The Finest Hours and 50 Shades of Black just don't have the oomph to overtake it in the box office. The big question is, how much will Kung Fu Panda bring in? And this will dictate whether there's a sequel, whether they finish the other three movies, and whether this January release date is actually good for a movie like this. I'm going to say it's going to make about $45 million. I think it's going to do pretty well. It's not going to make $60 million, which is, I think, what the first one did. And even with the 3D bump in, what, 7 years? 8 years difference? That's still quite a bit down. But I think $45 million would be successful for this one, especially since it's getting a big push in China, where it's going to make the most of its money back. Anyways, because it takes place in China, and the Chinese love films, especially when they're about them. which is everybody. I mean, Americans love films about America. So, hey, why can't the Chinese do it too? You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous home cinema roundup. Topping off the list is another thing from Jack Black. After he's out of his panda suit, or behind the panda microphone, we've got Goosebumps, which I liked. I thought was a cute enough movie. It's based on the Goosebumps book. I thought they did a great job with making it true to the book series without just doing a single episode of Goosebumps like the old TV show. Burnt is out there. This one I didn't see. This is one of the notches in the belt for Bradley Cooper's terrible releases in 2015. You had stuff like Serena and Aloha, and now you got Burnt. So he did not have a good 2015. The Assassin, which is getting a lot of award buzz. It's a Chinese film, but it's just so boring and so long and drawn out. Yes, it's beautifully shot, but it's so deliberate. It's almost aggressively deliberate. Then there's Meet the Patels, which is an interesting story about a guy through his own life examining the concept of arranged marriages in the Indian tradition. Doctor Who, season 9, part 2. We talked about Doctor Who not coming back for a 10th season until 2017. But you can get season 9, part 2 now. There's also Downton Abbey, season 6. I don't watch it. I have no desire to watch it, but I understand it's very popular, so you can check that one out as well. That's it for this week. I need to go. And in the meantime, you can anticipate what I have to say next week about The Choice, Hail Caesar, and Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.